You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, September 23rd, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, finally, Iran reciprocates on the eve of the annual meeting of the UN General Assembly. Will President Obama sit down with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani and somewhere make John McCain shed a tear? Also on the program today, the Department of Justice never probed the NSA wrongdoing. So much for checks and balances. Egypt has banned the Muslim Brotherhood. Obamacare open enrollment starts a week from today. And you will not believe the lengths the right wing is going to convince people they shouldn't get health care. Also on the program today, one of the members of Pussy Riot, imprisoned in Russia, goes on a hunger strike. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. We are just a couple of housekeeping notes. We are working with a new board today. We had some major technical problems last week, as you know, and we have determined, well, we were faced with the challenge of what is the common denominator that is frying our computers, frying our phones, our soundboards, our other sound devices. And it was ultimately two things. One was it's either the board or just that everyone in the office who uses this equipment has no idea what they're doing. And because it is just too expensive for us to replace everyone in the room, including myself.
I still haven't ruled out the latter there.
No.
Yeah.
That still may be a problem, but we decided to go ahead and purchase a new board. So last week was, if we ever get to the point where the show has to go under because our revenue and our spending is out of whack, the board, the computer, the computers, and the app, that'll be the week. We will be able to point to that second week or third week in September, and we will know that that's why. In the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, hopefully by now you're aware that our Android and our iOS apps, so for the iPhone and the iPad, have been released. If you have not gotten it yet, the easy way to get it, go to majority.fm/app. Fairly straightforward, /app, or search for it on your respective marketplaces. We've had well over 1,000 people, close to 2,000 people in the past couple of days download the app. We have really no sense of how many people have mobile devices, but certainly a lot of people. That's a lot of downloads in a short period of time, particularly for a show of this size. So it's, you know, it's a small percentage of our listenership, but it's significant. And it's a great way. I have already heard from multiple people that they have turned people onto the show because of the app. because the app is such an easy way to listen to the program. We're already seeing people downloading and or streaming old shows through the app. We got, of the many emails we've gotten, the app has now made me fully turgid, says listener Rick. The app is great and worth the money. I shall eventually PayPal to you. But a question, with the app's download capability, will it screw you over in terms of iTunes stats if members and subscribers quit using the podcast feed and just start going straight with downloading via the app? For members, is not an issue because we don't house our stats do not include members' downloads, at least via iTunes. For subscribers, yes, it will impact, I think, our iTunes downloads, I believe, but we don't care. We think this is a great way for people to listen to the show. It makes it much easier. It's much easier to introduce people to the show. So with that said, give the app a really good review. You can still go on iTunes. You can go to majority.fm/review. Give the show a good review. And, of course, on the app, not only can you IM us and one-touch call us, the live show, but you can also, with a touch, get to a donate page if you want to throw us a little coin to help support the development of the app and, of course, the show in general. We would not have a problem with that. In fact, we would be excited about that. I know maybe I'm underselling a little bit, but what can you do? The app is great. I couldn't be happier. We've had some problems with Android, but that was to be expected because Android has multiple different functionality depending on the piece of hardware you have. So, and just a reminder, when you go to iOS and you download the app, you're going to have to sign a long letter of agreement. This is not our letter. This is the case with any app you download after the Apple's move to iOS 7. So you got to sign off on that, regardless of what app it is. It was just a coincidence. One more obstacle we wanted to see if we could overcome.
So that means if you've already downloaded an app after you've updated to iOS 7, or even if you didn't, you get it either way. So if you've already downloaded an app since iOS 7 came out, you won't have to do that for us because you've already would have done.
That's right. So don't panic if you don't see it. You just, you've already dealt with that. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Matt Duss. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show, the second time in a couple of weeks, Matt Duss. He is a policy analyst from the Center for American Progress. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
Obviously, we're on the eve of a meeting of the General Assembly. There's a lot of speculation that perhaps President Obama will meet with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. I covered Rouhani's comments a little bit at the end of last week, but just walk us up to where we're at and why the comments that Rouhani made last week were different, at the very least in tone, if not in substance, and the implications of it.
Right. Okay. Well, in June, Iran had its presidential election. I think your listeners may remember that in June 2009, 4 years before, there was a presidential election that led to mass demonstrations, the largest seen in Iran in many years, because many believed, and I think evidence indicates, that that election was an unfair one, that the votes were not counted correctly, and that the candidate that many people thought would win, Mirhossein Mousavi, who was a pro-reform candidate, he had the election stolen from him on for Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the very inflammatory president who went on to serve a second term. This time, however, the candidate who won, Hussein Rouhani, he's a regime cleric, very close. He's a regime insider. He's not a reformer in the same way that many believed Mousavi was, but he was still the most moderate available candidate.
Matt, let me stop. Let me stop you right here. I've heard many people echo the same sentiments about the election, the second election of Ahmadinejad. When we talk about that election being unfair, that there was some questions as to the outcome, simultaneously we know that Ahmadinejad did not necessarily have the greatest of relationships with the supreme leader. That's my understanding. Correct me, please, if I'm wrong. But so who would be responsible for having for any hijinks that took place during that election?
Well, I think the circle around the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, if the election were fixed, and again, it's hard to say definitively, but I think the evidence is that it was. But it's important to note here that relationship between Ahmadinejad and Khamenei deteriorated very quickly after the election. I mean, okay. They were very close. Khamenei was seen as a key sponsor of Ahmadinejad, but basically Ahmadinejad, having won re-election, very quickly got too big for his britches and started to install his own followers and kind of try to make changes without the juice to do that. And he created a lot of enemies, and he empowered a lot of people who hated him anyway. So Khamenei, within a few months of that re-election, kind of decided, okay, this guy is just too much trouble, and signaled in various ways that he was no longer going to support Ahmadinejad. And, the sharks began to circle, and eventually he was taken down, and he will, now go on to do whatever he does in the future. It's hard to say how relevant he will be. Maybe he'll get his own show like Sarah Palin. I don't know. But so now we've
got. They could maybe do a show together, and that would be amazing. I would watch that.
I think that would be the greatest idea for Crossfire that I think anyone has ever. Anyway, you go to this past June, and you had, there were several candidates who were seen as being preferred by Khamenei. But Rouhani was seen as the most moderate candidate. He's someone who ran on a platform of rapprochement with the international community, saying we need to improve our relations because the economic situation in Iran as a result of international sanctions on Iran has had some very, very damaging effects. And so his promise was, I'm going to work with the international community to do away with some of these sanctions and improve our situation and sort of re-engage and reintegrate Iran into the international system. And so that's what he's been, his rhetoric since winning has been toward that. He's taken a number of significant steps, made a number of significant statements. The people he staffed his administration with, particularly the new foreign minister, Zarif, is known and trusted among Western diplomats as a serious and pragmatic man. And importantly, as I note in my piece last week, it's one thing to have an Iranian president who says these sorts of things, as we can refer back to Mohammad Khatami, who was the president in the late 90s. But it's another thing to look at the supreme leader and what the supreme leader is saying. Khamenei, as the supreme leader, the way the Iranian system is arranged, he is the final decision maker. He is the one who has the most power in the system of government in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So for him to be supporting Rouhani's outreach, as he has done, saying the things that he is saying in a speech to Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps, a very powerful military organization, last week, he said, listen, we need to show, quote, a heroic flexibility towards some of these political decisions. I think is a very, you can clearly interpret that as saying, we need to create the political space here to allow Rouhani to do what he needs to do. He was a sort of warning to some of the more hardline elements in the Iranian system, saying, back off, give this, you know, give Rouhani some space to run.
And the fact that he made those statements about flexibility to what is arguably the largest cross-section of power and, I guess, sort of anti-Western and conservative in the context of Iranian politics,
right.
That's extremely relevant, right? I mean, he's going into the source of if there's any pushback to these initiatives, it's going to come from there.
Exactly. So he was essentially saying to Iran's own hardliners and anti-Western hawks, like, listen, everybody, just calm down. I'm supporting what Rouhani is doing. And it was a very important signal.
And so and this is also, I think, contextually speaking, in terms of understanding the Khamenei's, I guess, incentives here and agenda. Iran is dealing with some severe economic problems.
Mm-hmm. Right. The inflation in Iran is skyrocketing. You know, various goods and imports have been stopped. Iran has been cut off from the international banking system. Various measures that have been taken by a cooperation of international of countries and international organizations has been significant. The damage is really being felt. And so I think it's a combination of two things. One, you had President Obama's outreach when he came into office, making clear to the people of Iran and the government of Iran that the United States does not seek regime change. I mean, this is a suspicion, bordering and sometimes crossing that border into outright paranoia on the part of a lot of Iran's leaders, including the Supreme Leader, that whatever the United States might say, the goal of the United States has always been the destruction of the Islamic Republic. So saying what President Obama did, but then offering to negotiate and coming to the table. But once we got to the table and Iran was not willing to deal in a way that the U.S. and its international partners saw as being forthright, then turned to the sanctions and pressure track. And he has been able to forge a very, very effective and strong multilateral coalition to enforce these sanctions.
I mean, in some respects, that posture by President Obama has been an incredibly successful foreign policy, policy.
I agree. I think it's something that is it's underrecognized here. I think you had a lot of our own hardliners here in the United States who have always scoffed and been skeptical at the value of kind of public diplomacy and outreach and saying these kinds of things to Iran. But I think a lot of people have recognized that it was precisely that outreach, that demonstration of good faith, that played a very important role and acted as a force multiplier for the pressure efforts that were then undertaken.
And just to tease that out, when you say force multiplier, what you're talking about is President Obama essentially calling their bluff, brought other players to the table who would create a united front.
Right, exactly. By taking every effort to show that it was not the United States who was the recalcitrant party, by saying we are willing to come to the table to talk about all issues, we will talk bilaterally, we will talk about whatever you want to talk about. But obviously the nuclear program is still the most immediate challenge and concern. By demonstrating that willingness to talk, they put the Iranian regime on its back foot. Because the claims that the Iranian hawks had always made were like, the U.S. isn't interested in talking to us. They just want to destroy us. So it demonstrated something very important to Iranians domestically, but it also demonstrated something to the rest of the world.
And I have to say that I think for the most part, our machismo, I've recovered from a lot of this. I know how embarrassing it is to have a president come up and sound almost like he's apologetic, like he's going to negotiate. But I feel like, that may be easier for me because I'm sort of metrosexually. All right. So leaving that aside, is one of the other factors that is driving and we don't know how sincere yet. That's the issue that we're going to get to. But
right.
Driving this impetus, at least to put on even the most cynical of us, this show, how much, knowing that much of what happened in the Arab Spring was a function, at least in the beginning, of economic issues.
Right.
How much concern is there in Iran that their economic pressures are could be similarly destabilizing for their internal regime?
Oh, I think there's a great deal of concern. I think, you know, part of what led to the 2009 demonstrations was, you know, a similar sort of thing. It was not only that Mousavi, that Mir Hossein Mousavi, was promising, you know, an attempted rapprochement with the international community. He was recognizing a lot of the same problems that Rouhani is now recognizing, even though they have gotten much worse in the intervening 4 years: the lack of economic development, the lack of opportunity. You know, the chance for a brighter future. So, you know, economic factors were one of those things that drove that, because they felt that many young Iranians especially felt that they were being denied those opportunities when they saw, as they saw it, Mousavi's victory was stolen from them. So, you know, the supreme leader, I think the fact that even though Rouhani was not seen as being his preferred candidate, he understood that it was in his interests, now that Rouhani has actually won, that he, you know, the system just simply couldn't bear another uprising like that. There's a certain extent to which the supreme leader is very concerned about, you know, the legitimacy of the system. And even in authoritarian systems like the Islamic Republic, you know, the public opinion and a sense of the correctness and legitimacy of the system is still important, even, you know, if it's to a lesser extent than in a real democracy. But it's still a factor that plays.
And you know, we have the last 2 years, I mean, I think as evidence of that. Rouhani gets in, and he, you mentioned that he appointed Zarif, his foreign minister, and Zarif also now, importantly, has the portfolio, I guess the nuclear negotiations portfolio. What are the implications of that?
Right, but a couple months ago, the nuclear negotiations portfolio was handed by the National Security Council of Iran, which meant it was essentially a military dominated portfolio. Moving it to the civilian foreign ministry, you know, is both, you know, is a sign just that we're moving out of the hands of the military, but also putting it under much greater control of Rouhani and his appointed foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif. So I think it's important just because you're moving it out of the hands of the military, but it's also important because it's yet another sign of support from the supreme leader to Rouhani. It simply would not have happened had Khamenei not signed off on it.
Now much of at least the sort of the awareness of what's happening was a function of Rouhani's interview with NBC the last week, where he reiterated the Iran's determination not to have a military program when it comes to nukes. So this isn't necessarily new, is it? But have we ever heard it so explicitly articulated?
Not for a while from an Iranian president. I mean, given that we've had Ahmadinejad for the last 8 years, but it is something that Iranian leaders have said repeatedly since their nuclear program was revealed in 2002. But I think, you know, it's notable just for the venue in which it was said, an interview with a Western journalist. But yeah, it's not new. I think the real notable thing from that, as I noted, was, you know, the fact that Rouhani said very confidently, "I have the backing to make a deal." I think that is the real news here. That as Iran analyst Houman Majd, who's very, very, you know, intimately familiar with the details of Iranian politics, he said, you know, the Iranian leadership is in sync right now in a way he has not ever seen.
And so, is this, how much of this is a function of what has taken place? What is happening in Syria in terms of their civil war, but what is also what has taken place in terms of what now appears to be the averting of our involvement, the United States involvement in the Syrian conflict, and perhaps a, if not in practice, at least in theory, some type of chemical weapons, new regime imposed upon Syria. How does that play into the timing of this? Is it simply coincidental? Is somebody seizing on an opportunity? What's the interplay there?
Well, I think with regard to Syria, it's somewhat coincidental, although I think the fact that President Obama was willing, you know, after having sort of sat on the sidelines, although that's not entirely a fair, summary of the policy, but just seeing that President Obama was willing to get involved and do what he would, go to the mat for strikes over the question of WMD, chemical weapons, I think sent an important message to the Iranians. But also, I think some have suggested that Iran, that what's happening in Syria, this civil war, is to Iran's benefit. And I just don't think that's true at all. I think you've got a situation where it's not exactly like Vietnam. In many ways, it's similar. You've got the Syria, who's the most important ally in the Arab world for the Iranians. They're involved in backing him. They've got advisors there. They've got fighters there. They are just engaged in that conflict in a way which I think is steadily causing greater harm and discouragement for them. So the possibility that they could now use the Syria situation as another front on which to possibly come to some sort of working relationship with the United States is a positive thing for them.
And I mean, so the message that President Obama sent by suggesting that he was prepared to attack Syria was what? I mean, how is that received? That this guy is just serious? But I mean, what exactly how did they respond to the fact that he slow walked it enough that a deal developed, if not orchestrated a deal?
It's really hard to say. I mean, I think there are plausible arguments both ways about how they interpret it. I think one of the interesting things about the whole Syria debate that's happened over the last month is how difficult it is to actually determine what various adversaries have, how they've interpreted various decisions and non-decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But I think just, you know, the extent to which the Syria debate here in the U.S. underline this administration's concern with the question of chemical weapons and the broader WMD question, you know, sent them an important message.
And so what is it that we want? I mean, let's, in John McCain's worst nightmare, President Obama sits down with Rouhani this week, and they come out with a document that, you know, starts to head into a direction. What would that look like from the perspective of U.S. security interests?
Well, first of all, the main thing is that we need Iran to receive a clean bill of health from the International Atomic Energy Agency. The IAEA has a set of questions relating to possible military applications of Iran's nuclear work that Iran has yet to answer sufficiently. So getting the IAEA sign off that Iran has produced evidence or answered those questions to the IAEA satisfaction is, you know, it just an immediate goal to kind of bring Iran back into compliance with the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So I think that answering the nuclear questions is the main thing. Then, you know, getting into, you know, what is Iran able to do? Will it have domestic enrichment? What will be the level of monitoring and cooperation? It will have to be very extensive. So I think those are the immediate questions and issues that have to be addressed.
And when the IAEA looks into this question, what they're looking for is to the extent that uranium has been enriched, right? I mean, if it's 20%, that is for civilian purposes. If it goes up to, if it's somewhere between 20 and 100, it shows that there's an attempt to do something else with this material. And part of our concern is we don't know where they are in terms of the enrichment, and I'm asking this. We don't know where they are with their enrichment, and part of the concern is also getting from 0 to 20% is more of a challenge than going from 20% to 100% in terms of slowing that roll, if you will.
Right. I mean, well, first of all, we have a good idea, or at least the IAEA thinks it knows, because it does have monitoring equipment in Iran right now. That's something I think a lot of people don't understand, is that, you know, Iran is open to inspections right now. The question is, how extensive are those inspections? And the concern is, are there facilities right now that the IAEA and others do not know about? So that's part of Iran answering those questions. So it's not, the main thing is not how much enriched uranium does Iran have, and how heavily is it enriched. You know, there's also questions of what experiments have they carried out with nuclear application or with weapons applications, such as triggering mechanisms. That's one of the main questions with the Parchin facility north of Tehran that people may have heard about. This facility that there were concerns and some evidence, although it's not clear how strong the evidence was, that there were experiments carried out relating to, you know, the use and development of nuclear triggers that could be used in a nuclear weapon. That facility has been basically razed to the ground now without letting the IAEA take a look at it, which obviously does not instill confidence in people. But those are the kinds of questions that the IAEA is going to need answered.
And how do we know about facilities we don't know about? I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? I mean,
just we got into that a similar thing with Saddam. It's like, you know, prove to us you don't have the weapons you don't have. But I think the IAEA, you know, they're not going to completely ask Iran to prove a negative. It's just they're, you know, they have certain questions and they need those questions answered.
And so just, you know, bring this out and tease this out for us. So they interview a range of people, and from those interviews and from the experiments that are conducted somewhere, they basically fit together what they know what a weapons program would look like, and they know what a civilian program would look like. And if there's some discrepancy within the civilian program, like, hey, you know, that guy seems to be very interested in X or Y, or they seem to be, you know, they've ordered one of those machines that weaponize things. That's a weird thing to buy. Is that basically what it is?
That's it. And you've also got, you know, intelligence from various member groups. You've got intelligence from the United States. You've got intelligence from Israel that they can submit to the IAEA, and the IAEA will follow up with that in interviews and other investigations. You know, and sometimes the line here between, you know, what's weapons-related work and what's not is not exactly clear. I mean, under the NPT, it's not illegal to kind of run computer simulations about you know, certain things that have a weapons application. Some have different applications to different things. So basically, the IAEA just, again, to repeat myself, I mean, there are certain very direct questions that they feel that Iran has kind of been, you know, dancing around and has not answered yet.
Now, the IAEA has this evidence that presumably comes from Western intelligence agencies and who knows where else. Do they ever show this evidence to the Iranians and say, like, here, take a look at this. How do you explain this?
They do to some extent, but, you know, I think this is a concern that the Iranians have, and it's and because they're not, they constantly challenge the provenance of such evidence. You know, and it's not without foundation. I think the initial revelation of Iran's nuclear weapons related work in 2002 came via the MEK, the Mujahideen Ikhalq, which is an Iranian anti-regime terrorist group. You know, so Iran does have some grounds to raise suspicions about evidence when it comes from sources like that. But yeah, I mean, the problem here is that Iran has a pattern of behavior, keeping these activities secret that really do raise, I think, legitimate questions about their claims that their program is entirely peaceful.
And so, what do you think the chances are of a meeting between Obama and Rouhani? And to the extent that there is one, how much will we hear about it?
If there is a meeting between Obama and Rouhani, I don't know how likely that is. If there is one, it will be basically a meeting in the hallway and a handshake. So I think there will be – I don't think there is any – one who imagines that they'll actually, you know, go into a room and sit around a table and talk, although certainly don't want to rule that out. I mean, that might be too much too fast. You know, we got to find out if Iran is really into us. You know, what we're going to see is Kerry sitting down with the foreign minister, Zarif. I think that in itself is a huge step. Mm-hmm. I don't think Iranian Iranian and U.S., you know, the highest level, the Secretary of State and the Iranian Foreign Minister have met. I can't even remember the last time that happened. But I saw a report just a few hours ago that that's in the works right now. So, yeah, you know, small steps, but they are positive steps.
Okay, and I've alluded to John McCain weeping this week in jest, but he probably is, right? I mean, how is this being received? Like, what do they do now? I mean, you know, I'm quite convinced that for the neocons, you know, China is sort of always looming in terms of,
right.
You know, this we've got our boogeyman in the back pocket, and this is the one that
right.
we're really worried about. But Iran has been sort of their go-to boogeyman since basically the day after shock and awe.
I think Iran, yeah, was one of the ones they went to. I mean, you brought up China, and I think that's great because I think if you remember the early, you know, spring and summer of 2001, and you remember like the Hainan Island incident. China was it. I mean, they were gearing up for China, and then all of a sudden 9/11 happened, and they hit pause on China, and all of a sudden it was Islamic extremism.
I spoke in 2004 to Gary Hart, who was one of the co-chairs of a commission called like the 21st Century Potential Enemies of the United States Commission. That basically had provided just literally weeks, I think, before the 9/11 attack that Al-Qaeda was the problem. But he said to me that they met on the first day, and there was about 20 people around a table. They went to every single person. Who is your biggest concern, or what is the biggest concern that you think the United States has from a security standpoint? Almost to a person, they all said some variation of Al-Qaeda. Except for one person who said China, China, China. That person was Lynn Cheney, and apparently she didn't come back for the second meeting, according to Gary Hart. And so
yeah.
This is, are we going to see? I mean, are we going to see something like this from the neocons, where there's some squawking about Iran, but if things go the way that people hope, that this they'll have to pivot at one point back to China? I mean, is it or do we have a couple of years where they can still bomb Iran?
Well, no, I think they always sort of keep the pots on simmer, whether it's Russia or China, so they can, you know, they can heat those things up whenever it's politically advantageous for them. But I think the immediate concern here is, you know, you're already seeing noises from very hardline, you know, members of Congress and outside groups making these wild demands, you know, for anything, the very minimum that the United States can accept, whether it's, you know, no domestic enrichment for Iran, which I think is just a complete non-starter and shows a total lack of seriousness about what an actual agreement would entail. So in the immediate term, I think people should keep an eye, you know, understanding that Obama and Rouhani both have their own domestic hardliners that they have to deal with. I mean, I joked the other day, it's like there's almost an unwritten agreement between some of these hardliners in Iran and the U.S. and elsewhere that, you know, they're going to try and tear down any opportunity for rapprochement when it arises. And that's what we're seeing right now.
I guess that basically it's just a countdown until John McCain and Lindsey Graham demand that Khamenei cut his beard for any type of agreement or something to that effect.
Right, exactly. He needs to wear an Uncle Sam American flag style top hat and cut his beard and pledge allegiance to the flag.
An anti-Obamacare ad too, maybe.
That's right. Yeah, so I think the challenge right now is, you know, pushing back on some of these people who are trying to raise the bar to just completely unrealistic levels.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out, and if this meeting between Kerry and Zarif takes place, this is going to be a major breakthrough. Matt, I appreciate you coming on and previewing it, its potential for us.
Great. Always happy to be here.
Matt Duss, folks, policy analyst at the Center for American Progress. It is now that time where we will head into the better half of the program. I really do. You got to feel bad for John McCain and Lindsey Graham. These guys, what are they going to do with themselves? I guess short of, boy, that... came in late. What are they going to do for themselves besides complain about Ted Cruz?
It was like Lindsay was just waking up.
What's that?
It was Oh,
yes.
You know, he was just, he was kind of like, what?
I know what
you're doing. He was dozing. He was dreaming about bombing Shiraz. And then you said it and the door creaked open.
In the better half of the program, we will talk about Ted Cruz, who apparently has really just made a fine mess of things for himself. He now has, as far as I can tell, all of his Republican colleagues in the Senate hate him. The Republicans in the House hate him. And he has really orchestrated. I mean, you've actually got Republican writers, right-wing writers now saying, calling the defund Obamacare plan the Palin-Cruz plan. She is the gift that keeps on giving. This is all a function of the voting of the continuing resolution by the House that contains language to defund Obamacare. It heads to the Senate. And now the Senate Republicans are trying to figure out what they're going to do with this disaster on their hands. And then the question, of course, is whether or not President Obama will cave. We will talk about that later in the program. Also, Obamacare does open enrollment starts October 1st. And the right wing is responding by putting out I don't want to say this in a way that sounds like hyperbole, but I don't know how else you can characterize this short of rape ads suggesting that Uncle Sam is going to rape people if they get health insurance. It's just bizarre. I think ultimately a perfect example of how the right-wing machine works, where you've got a bunch of billionaires and they are just seen as complete suckers by some of the right-wing apparatchiks. And they come in and they just like, how can we separate this guy from his money? I know. Throw in a little bit of misogyny, throw in a lot of Obama hate, and I'm about to make some big cash. We will talk about that in the better half of the program. Tom DeLay, the hammer, we didn't get to it on Friday. The bug man, his conviction overturned. And you will not believe on what grounds they overturned it. This case of bribery was, or money laundering, I should say, was essentially he was found innocent of money laundering because essentially they just basically bribed him.
You don't get it. It's not that complicated.
Yeah,
it's a direct
folks,
bribe. You got to wash money for
exactly,
money laundering.
Exactly. Exactly. There's
just
no
took
money.
It.
It's just a bribe. Also, in Egypt, as I mentioned, has banned the Muslim Brotherhood in a horrible terrorist attack in Nairobi, by Al-Shabaab, how would you describe this? Somali?
They're Somali.
Transformed?
They're aligned with Al-Qaeda.
Okay.
They were a local terrorist group, and they've kind of formally joined forces with Al-Qaeda.
And we will get to one of the funnest parts about the hot GOP on GOP action that took place last week regarding the defunding of subsidies for their own staffers, something that we have tried to institute in this office as well. All right, folks, we're going to take
a
break.
We're eligible for subsidies? What?
No, don't. 646-257-3920 is the number. If you have the app, you can simply listen live and just press Call Sam, 657-257-3920. You can IM the show. I'll take your IMs.
Whoa, whoa,
I think
whoa.
The
six. What did you just? You just gave the wrong number. I think.
No, I didn't. 656.
646.
Oh, geez.
You keep saying 656 over and over again.
646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. And you can IM the show, of course, with just to press the button.
Are you okay over there?
No. 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 Just a heads up. Nikki has returned to work, which is why I wasn't openly weeping last week about the cost of the app and the computers. That's just why I was in a bad mood. But I wasn't reduced to tears. Our failure to get Saul to sleep through the night has now created a big dilemma, because she needs sleep and I need sleep. And that is a problem, because Saul won't sleep. And she's going to have to start to travel a little bit, and we're trying to figure out how that's going to work.
Sounds like good for Matt and I's careers.
Oh, yeah. By the way, thanks for filling in for us today on the Matt and Mike show.
It was my pleasure. It's always an honor to fill in for Matt and Mike on Matt and Mike Mondays. Matt, don't panic. Don't send me a bunch of emails. I know I'm already going to get a bunch. How come you? Where was Matt and Mike? We were just getting used to it. It was fun to watch, you know, Mike and Matt slowly, very, very slowly develop. All right, we'll take a break. We'll be right back after this.